I'll call to order the General Government Consumer and Small Business Protection Committee. Colleagues, today is March 20.
Van Carter.
I'll call to order the General Government Consumer and Small Business Protection Committee. Colleagues, today is March 21st, 2011. We are here for the purposes of a work session to Ways and Means on Senate Bill 655 and public hearings on Senate Bill 667. We're going to send 768 to Ways and Means and then public hearings on 944, 484, 826, and Senate Bills 827. So that you'll have a sense of what order we're going to go in, we're going to go in order, all the way through, I believe. So we're going to do 655 first, 667 second, 768 third, 944 fourth, and then the three big consumer protection bills, 484, 826, and 827. I don't believe that any of those are ready to move today, so the only actual work sessions I anticipate doing will be on Senate Bill 655 and 768, and that will be to send both of those to Ways and Means because they have significant fiscal impacts. That being said, I will open a work session on Senate Bill 655. Patrick, do you want to tee it up?
Sure, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Senate Bill 655, we heard this bill back on February 23rd. It's a bill that would create the Commission on Immigrant and Refugee Affairs. You have in your packet a fiscal and revenue impact statement for this bill. The fiscal impact statement indicates that there will be a cost involved with creation of a new commission, and so the Legislative Fiscal Office has requested that this measure receive a referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Also, you'll note in your packet a sheet of testimony from Darlene Taylor, who's a commissioner with Oregon Commission for Women. Included in the record, Mr. Chair.
In support?
It is not in support, Mr. Chair.
No, not in support. Okay. Okay. Can we get a motion on Senate Bill 655? Senator George?
Mr. Chair, I move that we refer Senate Bill 655 to the Ways and Means Committee.
With a due pass.
If you want to add, here's my problem, Mr. Chair, is that my support on this bill had to do with there was no additional cost involved. Mm-hmm. So if you want to do passed, I'd prefer somebody else makes the motion.
Okay.
I want to see this go forward because I don't think there will be much fiscal impact, and I'd like to see the commission created if that's true, but I don't really actually in this environment want to be in support of creating additional liability to the general fund.
Sure, I can appreciate that. Patrick, can you tell us what the fiscal impact statement says as far as amounts?
Yes, Mr. Chair. The analysis indicates that the fiscal impact would be to the Oregon Advocacy Commission's office. It says minimal impacts to both the Legislative Assembly and Governor's office. The indicated other funds, the total funds expenditure for the 2011-13 biennium would be approximately $103,501. $84,000 of which would be general fund and $18,750 would be other funds.
Okay. Well, I can appreciate Senator George's concern. I think, you know, at the end of the day, Ways and Means are going to have to separate and make some policy decisions. I think I would feel more comfortable sending it down with a due pass, and I certainly don't mind you objecting to that referral.
Mr. Chair, I withdraw my motion.
Okay. Senator George has withdrawn his motion. As long as we're kind of in an ad hoc discussion phase, are the other committee members comfortable sending it down to Ways and Means with a due pass?
Mr. Chair, could you remind me if there was a discussion about whether the other commissions could handle these issues?
I think there was, but what the fiscal reflects is they would have to hire a 0.5 part-time position in order to expand their ability to handle it.
Thank you.
Senator Monroe?
I'm fine sending it down. I know there's a lot of work on the various commissions at Ways and Means, and this gives them the additional tool to work on whether or not this would be combined with some other, or staffing would be combined, or whatever. That would be up to the Ways and Means Committee, and so I'm comfortable sending it down there with a positive recommendation.
Yeah, and I think all we're saying is we like the idea, and they can then use their ability to reason and set the priorities as and compare this how they compare with other priorities that the state will be dealing with a massive $3 billion deficit that we have. But I think I feel comfortable sending it as well. Senator Monroe, would you feel comfortable making the motion?
Yes, I would move Senate Bill 655 be referred down to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Monroe has moved Senate Bill 655 to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Debbie, do we need any further discussion?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, yeah. I just want to make sure my position is clear on this. I actually applaud those folks who are pushing 655. I think they made a pretty compelling argument here in this committee that it wouldn't be additional cost. And I've seen a lot of times where fiscals kill bills, but in this environment, I'm trying to be a lot more leery of these types of things. So obviously it's not a reflection on the substance of the bill, but just simply the financial situation we are in the state. So yeah. That's the only reason I would object to this bill.
I can appreciate that. In fact, I did a similar objection in the Education Committee not long ago. So,
Mr. Chair, the Ways and Means Committee has made it very clear that they do not wish for policy committees such as this to send bills down there just to die. And being a member of the full Ways and Means Committee and two subcommittees, I concur with that. Too many times in past history, and I know about history, too many times the Ways and Means has been considered the graveyard. It was very easy for policy committees to send bills down there knowing that they would never see the light of day. We're not doing that with this. This is a positive addition to government, and I hope that the Ways and Means Committee will find a way to implement it without additional cost.
Further discussion? Debbie, please call the roll.
Senator Bonamici?
Aye.
Senator Berquist?
Excused.
Senator Monroe?
Aye.
Vice Chair George?
No.
Chair Shields?
Aye. Motion passes. This is on its way to Ways and Means. I will close a work session on Senate Bill 655 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 667. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 667 permits a state agency to enter into indefinite quantity contracts for architectural, engineering, and land surveying services if the agency anticipates a recurring need for the service and cannot specify in advance a particular quantity of services needed or makes a determination they should only award a contract for a minimum quantity of services. I can dispense with reading the rest of the summary since we'll have limited time, so we can get going and hear from the folks who are actually here to talk about the bill.
Okay. Is the only person we have to sign up to testify to this from ODOT? All right. Well, I think actually I'd prefer if the proponents had a chance to at least say why this bill is important, but I do appreciate ODOT being here. So at this point, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 667 and open a work session on Senate Bill 768. Public hearing on Senate Bill 768. Yes, Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 768 requires the Department of Administrative Services to conduct a study to assess disparities between the availability of and use of disadvantaged minority and women-owned businesses, enterprises, and public contracting, and to assess whether discrimination exists. The measure has an emergency clause and would take effect upon passage. We have in our packets, in your packets, Mr. Chair, the fiscal and revenue impact statements. The fiscal impact, if I may just briefly expand on that a little bit, as an indeterminate impact. However, it indicates that the actual impact is likely to be significant. It cites other disparity studies that were done, including ODOT's disparity study that they're currently in process of, and indicates a fiscal in the range of, it says ranging from 200,000 to just over $1 million per study in other states that it's in. And so there's a possibility of need for a Ways and Means referral for this measure also, Mr. Chair.
Great. Thank you, Patrick. Could we please bring up Mark Matthews and Melvin Odin Orr?
Good
afternoon, gentlemen. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Senator Shields.
Ready when you are.
I'm Mark with NAMAC. I'm the new president of NAMAC of Oregon. And
I'm Melvin O'Nor. I'm a counsel for NAMAC Oregon.
Okay. Mark, did you tell us your last name, too? I didn't catch it.
Mark Matthews.
Okay. Just, we need to get that on the record.
Senator Shields, we're here this afternoon to address Senate Bill 768, which addresses disparity studies. We're here to support that bill because disparity studies plays a very important role in addressing some of the concerns of members of the NAMC Oregon and the minority contracting community as a whole. I'd like to just give you a little bit of background about NAMAC Oregon. You have to excuse me, we just hurried down the hallway. So I'm going to catch my breath 1 second. Okay. NAMAC Oregon is a chapter of the National Association of Minority Contractors, which was formed in 1969. The local chapter of NAMAC has been most recently established in 2006. And the mission of the organization is to help in the education and training of minority contractors, create and promote the economic and legal interests of minority contractors, increase opportunities for minority contractors, and remove barriers to their ability to pursue their vocation and grow their businesses, and to create a forum where those members can share ideas and support each other. Some of the challenges that minority contractors generally face include things like access to capital, access to bonding and insurance, discrimination within the industry, and a lot of these barriers are sort of, you might look at them as being historical. And there are any number of things, historical in the sense of general discrimination within the state, moves on to discrimination within the industry and so on, all leading to some of the disparities that are, while they are historical in nature, may continue to this day. Some of those things would include things like dealing with stereotypes that all come from the history that has existed throughout the society. Now to the disparity studies specifically. Disparity studies, they're a constitutional requirement. Basically, the Constitution is, Supreme Court has said that in any case where a governmental body intends to take some action to correct historical discrimination, they must do so in such a way that it is narrowly tailored. And the reason is because anything that the government does that is based on race is subject to what's called strict scrutiny. And that strict scrutiny requires that there be an identification of a compelling state interest, and then that anything that's done to address that issue is done in a way that's narrowly tailored. And the Supreme Court has said that when the state acts to prevent discrimination, it is addressing a compelling state interest. And the strict scrutiny analysis requires that in order for it to be narrowly tailored, there must be an assessment of what the nature of the exact problem is. And that's where disparity studies come in. I want to note that disparity studies in themselves are not the answers to the problem, to the problems that we face, including the problems that I just mentioned. What the disparity study does is it gives the jurisdiction the factual basis from which they can determine how to proceed to address the problems. So it is merely the first step in the process. And so it is usually up to the jurisdictions to fashion a remedy that is appropriate for the situation that they're addressing. Unfortunately, the disparity study and even the state's efforts are, unfortunately, designed to, in the context of construction, for example, the remedies must be designed to address the particular industry that they're dealing with, the area that they're focusing on. And so things like the minority achievement gap would likely not be something that can be considered in looking at disparities with respect to the construction industry, because that's a generalized discrimination issue outside of the industry. Things like barriers to entry into the trades might be something that the disparity study can't properly address. So there are a myriad of problems that don't fall within what the disparity study is able to do or to able to account for. And so the challenge is, in the context of obtaining the study and using the study, there are other problems that are not taken into consideration. And so, again, it's just the first step, and we're always looking for ways to address those other problems that are just not caught into that net.
Thank you. Mr. Matthews, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I don't have much to say. I just wanted to recognize the chair that I'm the new president of NAMAC and just learning how to be a part of this. So.
Well, one thing you might help the committee understand, put a fair amount of time into this on the ODOT side, it having a disparity study, at least according to your prior chairman, he felt that laid the groundwork for breaking the logjam, if you will, with minority contractors at ODOT. Is part of your support based on hoping to take that same kind of experience to other state agencies?
Yeah, I think we have to look at it taking it through the state of Oregon instead of by region, and I think it's going to be a good thing to on the disparity study to help. I want to carry on what he started, but I think there's some items that we need to work on. So.
Okay. Any questions for this panel?
Yes, sir.
Senator George.
I was very interested in the testimony earlier on this bill, and so I went out and did some interviews of my own. One of the things that was said about some of the ways that some of the minority-oriented contracting is done in the state is it tends to isolate minority contractors in a certain part of a job, which means that you have just hypothetically say flagging on roads. So 90% of flagging is done by minority-owned businesses as a way to sort of take care of the necessary to have a minority business involved. So 90% of all the flagging is done by, I'm just making this up, but
yeah.
of a minority-owned business where the bulk of the contract is still in general construction or general contracting, and that the barrier is not that that minorities can't get 10% of the business. They can get 10% of the business if they're kind of locked in this box specifically over here. What I'm trying to get to is that I think that, I mean, I've heard that from enough people, but I think that that's probably true. Really what we're trying to do is you really want minorities to have at least 10% of the business of every part of the book of business, not just on this little corner of the book of business, if you understand what I'm saying.
Right.
So this is not really on point with this particular bill, but how do we get there? Because I don't really think it's fair, per se, that minority-owned businesses get 90% of this type of book of business, but I do think it's fair that we make sure that there's equal access to all of the book of business. So
good point.
Any insight in that? Because I'm a little worried that it passes, and we just perpetuate the problem. It's like we've patted ourselves on the head and say we solved the problem, but we didn't.
I would agree. That's I would probably give that categorize that as sort of ghettoizing public contracting, isolating contractors to particular types of work. I think that falls under the heading of capacity building, and the question is, for those individuals who aspire to build their business to become not just an engineering contracting firm or an electrical contracting firm, but to become a general contractor and perform work and supervise others in multiple trades, then they should have the opportunity to do that. And I think many of the members of NAMCO aspire to that level. But the issues that they face are, you know, it would be great if they could open up their, set up their shingle on Monday and then by Friday be able to bid a $10 million job. But there's a process that they have to go through for growth. And a major part of that growth requires an opportunity to actually do work, build a reputation, cultivate relationships until they can get to the point where, you know, they can go out and bid on that $10 million job and offer that two-year warranty and carry that $10 million bond that's required in order to do those kinds of things. And so we want to be where you want us to be, which is in that situation where they're not isolated to that 10% of the flagging work on this entire job. If that answers your question.
Yeah. I think so, but then the last part he said he's concerned that passing this bill would kind of continue that. Do you see passing this bill as a net positive or net negative? Could you address the last part?
It's a net positive because, as I mentioned, this is a prerequisite to the state or any jurisdiction being able to say, we think that there's a problem and this is how we want to correct it. Without identifying the problem, constitutionally speaking, the jurisdiction has no authority to address it. And this is a prerequisite. And so we support the bill. It needs to happen. And all the good things that the jurisdictions want to do after they have this in hand, more power to them. They'll get our support for it.
All right, good. Any other questions? All right, colleagues, I do think I'd like to send this down to Ways and Means as well with a due pass recommendation. So why don't I, we can get into the discussion about that in just a second. When I close, does anybody else want to testify on Senate Bill 768? I don't have anybody else signed up at this point. Okay. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 768 and open a work session on Senate Bill 768 for the purposes of sending this to Ways and Means with the due pass recommendation, potentially, if the motion happens. Senator George.
I move Senate Bill 768 to Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George moves Senate Bill 768 to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator.
Thank you. I support the bill and will vote. I have a little bit of a concern about the disparity in, well, no pun intended, in the fiscal between the $200,000 to $1 million per study, and I hope that in the Ways and Means process they can get a little bit more concrete information about what's expected in terms of cost on this. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Bonamici.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Monroe.
Yeah, have you gentlemen contacted the Commission on Black Affairs, and do you have their support for this legislation? The reason I ask you is I'm the Senate representative to that commission.
I'm not aware.
I'm not aware.
You might want to do that. There is a Commission on Black Affairs that meets so at least once a month, usually at PCC in Portland, and you got to find out who the key contact person is and get in touch with them and try and get their support for this bill.
Thank you, Senator.
Yes, sir.
All right.
If there's nothing further,
Senator George, just wait one moment.
I support the bill. My biggest concern continues to be this point where when you start talking exactly what you're saying, is it regardless of race, color, creed, or whatever, when people do startup, it takes a while for them to get their businesses going. And the biggest thing I'm concerned about with this is that regardless of somebody's, you know, race or religion or any other status, the fact is that we need to move these people through into the higher levels of contracting. And I'm concerned that what we're doing is we're putting certain classes of people in this lower end part of our contracting, saying we took care of the problem, and what it does is actually then also create market barriers for people to come in that may be of a majority or of a maybe not included in the list that's proven in a study to be disadvantaged. So a startup a startup guy who wants to start up a business. And so what happens is we need to figure out, once we pass these kind of things, how to move people through that process and then also make sure that the opportunities for emerging businesses is available for everybody. Because I think you guys have hit on exactly the point, but what I'm afraid of is that we're not moving people through, and it almost creates this ceiling that the same good old boys always control all the contracts, and regardless of race or sex or anything else, there starts to be a ceiling where people can't get past it. And this shouldn't be an additional barrier to new companies emerging into the process. So that's the only thing I'd say on this, is it really is a concern to me, and I want to raise that concern before we move to Ways and Means.
Great. Thank you, Senator George. I appreciate that. Could we get a motion, please?
There's a motion pending.
Why don't we go ahead and do the roll on this, too? Debbie?
Senator Bonamici?
Aye.
Senator Monroe?
Aye.
Vice Chair George?
Aye.
Chair Shields?
Aye.
And we can put Senator Boquist down as excused. So the motion passes. Senate Bill 768 is on its way to Ways and Means. Congratulations, gentlemen. Did a nice job.
Senators.
And I will close the work session on Senate Bill 768, and I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 944. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 944 prohibits the Oregon Liquor Control Commission from imposing minimum amount requirements for liquor purchases. You have provided with your packet the Dash 1 Amendment. The Dash 1 Amendment specifies that a single container purchase must be of an item of value of $50 or greater and be available through a U.S. distributor that does not require the Commission to acquire more than one case in a single transaction. We do not have any fiscal revenue statements on any of the versions of this bill at this point. So,
okay, and do we have the amendment as part of our packet?
Yes, it should be.
Okay.
Here's a copy of it.
Okay. All right. First up is Tobias Hogan. Mr. Hogan, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Senator.
Please proceed with your testimony.
This bill, 944, I'm supporting it as a business owner, restaurateur. I feel that it's necessary to pass to change the rules of the OLCC to allow us more access to unique spirits to differentiate our restaurants and bars in a highly competitive field.
Okay. Can you talk a little bit more about the genesis and why it was your idea to bring this
essentially
forward?
Myself and other colleagues have had a difficult time applying for special purchases with the OLCC. They've generally just gone nowhere. So because we can only access liquor through the OLCC, unlike beer and wine, which we can acquire through various distributors and wholesalers, I chose to try to get this bill drafted so that we might be able to acquire unique liquors. Things like absinthe, cordials, French cordials, other things like that that will differentiate us and offer us a little more advantage against other bars and restaurants, or just a variety of choice, essentially. Currently, and the nexus of the proposal was one of the requirements by the OLCC is, in fact, that you are required to buy an entire case if you do make a special order. So the issue arose when two things I've had on my menu from the beginning since we opened were recently dropped from the inventory of the OLCC, and another one is distributed by another liquor distributed by the same company I was looking to pick up. So essentially the three liquors that I would now be adding that are not in the inventory would be required by the OLCC to buy an entire case of each, which would cost me approximately $3,500, which I feel is a prohibitive amount of money for something that they have carried in the past and now have dropped.
Right. And what resonated with me is that, you know, going in with other bar owners to purchase a case defeats the purpose of you trying to distinguish yourself in the marketplace, right?
And exactly. So, and other people may not be interested in carrying those particular things enough to buy half a case or two-thirds of a case or whatever it might be.
Okay. And have you had a chance to review the amendments? And that?
Yeah, I did.
And I think OLCC was trying to be, I think, genuinely helpful, but they felt like, you know, if they had the same requirement for a bottle of MD 2020, that it might be complicated. From what I heard from staff, you had some concerns about the $50.
Yeah, I felt that the $50 price point was a little high. a person to make a special order for a bottle of liquor between $30 and $50 is reasonable. Under $30, I can understand their point. Okay. Between $30 and $50, I think, is still a range, especially for specialized bourbons from the South. A lot of those do hit between the $30 and $50 range.
Okay. So you'd feel comfortable with the $30 if we got that?
Yeah, I would. And the likelihood of somebody trying to special order a product that's under $30 for one or two bottles, which was the LCC's concern, is
probably not
doubtful.
Okay. But we'll hopefully we can work that out. We don't have the fiscal ready for today to move it anyway.
Sure. Senator George. Thank you. Really interesting bill, and I'm glad you brought it forward. In these specialized bourbons, how many units are usually in a case? I know you said
12.
12, okay. So you're talking about a significant investment. Even at $50, you're talking about a $600 investment.
Yeah.
Really to get a bottle of... That may not be used very often, so it's a high burden. So even at $50, it's a really high burden on specialized restaurants.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and few people would carry that kind of inventory.
Okay.
And you've also talked with some other bar and restaurant owners in
yeah,
the state.
Yeah, that's right. There are several restaurant bar owners that I know that have also tried to acquire various liquors, Armagnacs, French Accord called Sue's, and other bourbons from... I submitted a letter from Joel at the Pope House, who also has a concern about it. And in every instance, these special orders have gone away, essentially.
Do you ever order any booze from Luxembourg?
I haven't.
Because he could have helped you out at the duty-free shop maybe recently. Okay. All right, colleagues, is there anyone else? Thank you.
They're known for beer.
Bit of an inside joke. Anybody have any questions for Mr. Hogan? All right, thank you very much for bringing this forward.
Yep,
appreciate it. Would anybody else like to testify on Senate Bill 944? Is the director here? Do you want to make any comments? I would like to get a sense of whether or not you thought the $30 might be reasonable or if there's...
Yep. For the record, I'm Steve Farrow, director of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I'll just go ahead and go straight into the $30 question for the committee. I think we're flexible on that. The one thing that I want to bring out before we get started is that after reading the amendment over at the last minute, we would want to insert that this is special orders only, because if we carry a product normally, we should have no restriction on the number of items that they can order. So if they want to order one of a normally listed item, I don't want that to be misconstrued with this, that there's some sort of limit, because there is not.
Okay.
But for special orders, we would want to go ahead and have some control. I believe the previous testimony commented on the fact that there would possibly be some products out there that individuals would not want to have too much of. What we would want to go ahead and guard against is someone trying to go ahead and order one bottle of a $10 vodka, and we're required to get in 20 cases of it in order to go ahead and complete the order. We don't want to be pushed there. With regards to the $30, if that's where the legislature wants to go as far as a minimum amount for special orders, I think we're open to that. The reality of it is, for special orders, we're pretty flexible on those to begin with. This just puts it in a formal position here.
Okay, Becker. That would be great if you could work with Mr. Hogan on an amendment. And we're probably going to need to get this back into legislative council in the next 24 hours in order to pop it back out, in order to get it done without any complications. So if I really appreciate Director Farrow came and met with my office and then had staff call Mr. Hogan. I really appreciate that responsiveness. That's been my impression every time I've had either a neighborhood concern or an issue like this. Your office has been quite helpful, and we very much appreciate that.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 944, and I will, Senator Brennan-Michu, we're going into 484 first, right?
Right.
Okay.
So
and I will.
Your preference, and I would like if Patrick could get Mr. Quirin on the phone.
If I could open a public hearing on Senate Bill 484. No, go ahead.
Thank you. I believe the committee administrator is going to get Mr. Quirin on the phone, and while he does that, If I, Mr. Chair, can make a few introductory remarks?
Please.
Well, maybe I should wait for the phone so it's not distracting.
Apologies, Mr. Chair. We're actually ahead of schedule. Good figure.
Wow.
Don't tell us we're talking. The drive-in operation.
That's not the right number.
I don't think that's right.
Definitely not the right number.
Oh, I see what I did. I dialed the wrong number. Oh, yeah. I'm just going to call that one right there. Or, no, you're right. It should be a cell. It's right. I'm calling right. Yeah. Thank you. I think I'd be good at this by now, as much practice as I can. I'm going to get it.
He's an attorney. Real estate attorney.
Yeah. This is Phil Quirin. Please
right.
Leave your
wait,
name, number, sure. And time of your call, and I'll get back to you.
At the tone, please record your message.
Not going to work.
When you have finished recording, Patrick, do you may hang up or press one
try the other
options.
Can you try? Okay.
Mr. Quirin, this is State Senator Chip Shields. You are almost live in the state. General Government, Consumer, and Small Business Protection Committee. My staff, Patrick, will call you again perhaps in about 10 minutes, at about 10 minutes to 2 our time here on the West Coast. Thank you. Why don't we
Thanks.
Start with the opening comments from you, Senator
Yes, Bundy. Let's do that. So thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing me to make a few opening comments about this bill, which if you looked at the bill, you'd wonder, this is sort of a dry topic, but rather than have you try to read between the lines, I thought I'd make a few comments about why the bill is here. For centuries, property laws involved recording property transactions in county records. Recently, a law professor explained that a public, enduring, authoritative, transparent record of land ownership provides vital information infrastructure that's proven indispensable in facilitating not only mortgage finance, but virtually all forms of commerce. A recording is important to establish who has an interest in property that's for sale and resale, but also who has rights if a property is facing foreclosure. In Oregon, we use primarily non-judicial foreclosure, meaning it's done by notice and sale and not through a court proceeding. And our statute, which is 86735, says that a trustee may foreclose a trustee by advertisement and sale, meaning a non-judicial foreclosure. And I'll just read you the language because it's important. If the trustee, any assignments of the trustee by the trustee or beneficiary, and any appointment of a successor trustee are recorded in the mortgage records in the county in which the property described in the deed is situated. Well, in recent times, many of these assignments have not been recorded in the county records in Oregon. Instead, they've been tracked in an electronic database that's run by a company called MERS, which stands for Mortgage Electronic Registration Systems. It was created in the late 1990s, by the mortgage banking industry. They have a sort of slogan and a purpose. It says, process loans, not paperwork. And their website states that MERS saves lenders time and money and reduces paperwork by eliminating the need to prepare and record assignments when trading loans. Well, we're all about doing things more efficiently, but when we have a well-established recording process, this seems to go outside of it. And what's happened recently, there have been a couple of Oregon cases, and I'm not going to read this whole quote, but they talk about how MERS works, that it's a national electronic registry that tracks ownership interests. Through the MERS systems, MERS becomes a mortgagee of record for participating members. They buy into a membership of MERS, and then MERS is listed in the official records. Then the lenders retain the promissory notes and sell the interest without having to record the transactions. This database that they have, which is the sort of substitute for the public recording, it's updated by the MERS members, and those are typically the lenders. When a beneficial interest in a loan changes hands, the MERS member is supposed to send that information to the electronic database. It's called an electronic handshake. But it's not clear whether the MERS member actually has any legal obligation to do that. And, in fact, MERS actually disclaims responsibility for the accuracy and reliability of the information in the database. So that's what we have now instead of authoritative county records. So what does Senate Bill 484 do? Well, as explained above, in order to conduct a non-judicial foreclosure, all the assignments in the trustee must be recorded. That's clear in our statute, and that's what a Judge Frank Alley decided in a recent bankruptcy case in Oregon just last month. So what Senate Bill 484 does, it simply provides that in a trustee foreclosure, not in an advertisement and sale, not supervised by a court, the notice of the sale must include documentation that shows who's the real party in interest. And it shows the chain of title, including the assignments. So it's intended to clarify the requirement so that parties know what is required before the foreclosure occurs. There's a dash one amendment, and that's just to clarify that true copies of the documentation are acceptable. We aren't asking for original documents, but copies are fine to show the chain of title. This does not result in people getting to stay in their houses for free. It just complements what the courts have already held, that assignments must be recorded for a non-judicial foreclosure. I want to point out that MERS actually emphasizes how their business model has circumvented the state law and our county recording requirements. The MERS website states, eliminate the need to prepare and record assignments forever. Any loan registered on the MERS system is inoculated against future assignments because MERS remains the nominal mortgagee no matter how many times servicing is traded. Well, according to the MERS website, the savings are about maybe $23 for one transaction, $50 for two assignments. So that's a pretty insignificant cost in my opinion, colleagues, for you know, really the reliability of public records. So one more point I wanted to make, and it's a discussion for another day, but there's several states, including our neighbor to the south in California, where they've actually sued, I don't know who the plaintiffs are, but they're suing to recover the lost revenue for the counties for not being able to get the filing fees. So today, this bill seeks to clarify the requirements in those cases in which people are about to lose their homes without court oversight. Helps to assure that property rights are valid and that the law is being followed in such an important transaction. So we were going to have Mr. Quirin next. I hope he's answering. Mr. Quirin is a real estate attorney who's been in practice for, I believe, 40 years or so, 25 in real estate.
I think if you're a member, you can.
I can't, but the public can.
Get into it unless you have an accident.
That's interesting.
But I think.
Should we just go on the list, Senator Bonamici?
Yeah, there's another number there for him, though.
We can try the other number. That was his voicemail, I believe.
Yeah, it was.
Okay. Well, if it wasn't, well, staff will apologize. I'll try it one more time. Then, sorry, Mr. Chair. I'm afraid of an uprising.
Surely. He's an Oregon attorney, but he's out of state in a conference right now, which is why we're having trouble reaching him.
Anywhere in Dallas. So one, are we okay trying
to? Yeah, let's try the landline also.
So it's
2, 9, 1, 2. He might have turned off his phone.
Just ask her. We'll have to go room 22 when he comes up.
Okay.
So we'll go to the front desk.
you for calling the Sheraton Dallas Hotel. It will be our pleasure to assist you. To expedite your call, please listen to the following options. To reach the hotel operator, press 0. For reservations, press 1. To reach sales,
getting you booked on the Sheraton Dallas. This is Amy. I'm going to call.
Room 2022, please.
And again, same, please.
Phil Quarin.
I'm sorry?
Quarin, Q-U-E-R-I-N.
And the first name?
Phil.
I'd say, I wonder if there was a camera watching us, but of course there are cameras watching us.
The person in this room is not available to take your call. Please leave a message after the tone.
We'll go ahead. We have written testimony.
Okay.
You can see we did not make a good figure.
All right, we will...
best laid plans.
And if any of the proponents of the bill want to keep trying to reach him, feel free. So would you like to go into the list of testimony next, Senator Bonamici?
Yes, please.
Okay. Could we please bring up Stacey Howard, Tim Farrell, and Terry Scannell?
Good afternoon.
Welcome to the committee. Feel free to go first, whoever would like to.
Thank you. I'll go first. My name is Stacey Howard. I am a certified foreclosure prevention counselor. I've also managed a foreclosure prevention program here in Oregon for several years and have taught classes on foreclosure in addition to studying it in depth as much as I can. What I would say, thank you for having me testify, Senator Shields, and Vice Chair Senator George and the committee. What I would say about this bill is that the thing that I see consistently among the homeowners that I've talked to is that the contracts involved are very complicated, and the consumer's understanding of those contracts is a consumer's understanding. They're not legally trained. They're not trained in real estate law. They have a very limited opportunity before they enter into the contracts to really study what it is they're signing. And I think in this case, where you're talking about the biggest investment that the average American will ever make, you have to lean on the side of protecting the consumer. The servicers and investors have really unlimited resource to find ways not to comply with laws. But our consumers, when they're on behind the eight ball in these situations, often don't have the resource to even get an attorney to work with them to act on their behalf to see if things are happening in an appropriate way. Often what I see, I think, is less intentionally evil than it is sloppiness on the part of the servicing industry. I am not trained in the law. And so, to me, the technicalities of the MERS system are probably beyond even as much as I study this issue. They're beyond what I completely understand. But what I do know is that there are questions across the nation. Some cases have gone against MERS. Some have gone for MERS. There are so many problems with foreclosures right now, and I really think we need to close the loopholes for the consumers and the ways that they can be damaged. The resource is not equal, and you really have not a David and Goliath situation, but really a situation where you have someone who does not have the resource and the capacity to fight these issues on legal grounds, trying to prove whether or not they're correct. And again, I would say that most often these are accidents. When I see things go forward, when there's a question about a foreclosure where MERS is involved, I'm not going to say that the things are always intentional, but where do you go when you're dealing with a registry system? It is so hard to get to the person responsible to deal with these issues. And it just simply is, this is disservice to homeowners. And I think it's something that needs to be corrected, and this is a fairly easy, quick fix. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Hi, my name is Terry Scannell. I'm an Oregon attorney. I've been an Oregon attorney since 1985. But just by way, very quickly, of background, I had a career in government for 8 years before I went to law school, both in the city of Portland, back in Washington, D.C., worked for the U.S. Congress as a staff member, and then practiced law and went into business and had quite a long business career. So I try to look at these things, now I'm back in practice of law, and I have about five of these cases doing actual mortgage foreclosure defense. And I'd like to support some of what Senator Bonamici said about the bill. Basically, I see it as nothing more than a Transparency for Homeowners Act, is that the information that the bill would require to be part of the notice of sale would allow someone like me to very quickly assess and tell a homeowner, yes, you might have defenses, or no, you don't. And I think that it might surprise people to know that one of the things attorneys need to do is give their client their best advice. And sometimes that's to tell them that they don't have a defense. And so the ability to get this information on the table quickly and rapidly would, I think, be a help not only to the homeowners, but also to the industry, because it would prevent a situation from oftentimes when people walk in, attorneys, to these situations, you have a very compressed time horizon, oftentimes a week or 2 weeks, to put your claim in. So the ability to get this information teed up rapidly and to be able to make these decisions quickly and properly advise the homeowners, I think, would be very helpful. So really all we're talking about here, if you get right down to it, is getting the information out up front so that the homeowner and their advisors can quickly and efficiently give them their best advice and tell them, yes, you have a defense, or no, you don't.
Thank you very much, Chair.
Senators, Tim Farrell. I'm at 1235 Tucker Road in Hood River, Oregon. Senator Monroe, always a pleasure. See you again. In addition to being
a... I was wondering if this was a cemetery bill.
Coming over regularly.
It's all in the timing, right?
Yeah. Well, in addition to 20 years in the cemetery business, my legal practice focuses on unlawful foreclosures. Now, I don't have quite as much experience in this matter as I do with cemeteries, but I have been invited here by Nancy at Good Grief America to kind of share with you a practitioner's, you know, what we're going through, if you will. And I appreciate what Senator Bonamici is trying to do with Senate Bill 484, and I echo the sentiments that have been expressed here. Thousands of properties in this state have been foreclosed upon without proper documentation. Most homeowners in foreclosure can't afford an attorney, so there's no way for many of them to know if these foreclosures are even right or not, and as a result, most people just let them go forward, when in fact, they're all invalid, in my mind. However, well, the ones involving MERS, at least. I want to warn the committee, though, about some of the bank's positions. And I've got here a portion of a $29,000 memorandum of law that was drafted by a gentleman representing the Wells Fargo Bank. And basically what this memo says, and this is in case number, and I'm going to leave it here, but it's in case number 11CV00166 in the Oregon District Court there in Portland. And basically what Wells Fargo is saying is that this is all fine and dandy. The legislature can make all the rules it wants to in the state as to how to govern mortgage securities, but there's one problem. Those laws will all be preempted by federal law. So at the very least, as much as I want this legislation to go forward, at the very least, I think the committee owes it to itself and to its constituents is to make sure that whatever you do here today isn't in vain. I think you should talk to the Attorney General about getting some kind of an opinion, maybe even the Office of the Comptroller of Currency, because if you think that you're going to fix anything with this, you may be setting up your constituents for filing some kind of a lawsuit to prevent it from going forward because documents weren't filed, whatever, and then finding them faced with a motion to dismiss and being sanctioned for $29,000, $30,000 by these banks that will do everything. Ladies and gentlemen, they will do everything to make these things go through. Thank you so much.
Just briefly, to support something my colleague Tim said, is that an organization like Good Grief America is giving a lot of help to people on the ground, and I can't say enough good things about them. I think the other thing is that I totally agree with my colleague is that the issue of MERS merely is the tip of the iceberg. The things that I've experienced and seen as now part of my practice are business practices that I couldn't even imagine engaging in when I was in business, both as a small business owner and also running a $100 million P&L for a New York Stock Exchange company. So I don't know who got the message in the financial service industry that the rules don't apply to them, but that's certainly the position that I see them taking almost every day.
Thank you very much. Senator George.
I've got two quick questions, actually. The whole idea of registering it at the county courthouse is so that the public can easily access these records. What you're explaining to us, and what Senator, as I understood what Senator Bonamici explained to us, and this is all new to me, is that there is no way for the public to access these records that should be public records?
They can access the deed of trust. So the deed of trust is recorded at the county clerk.
But they don't know who actually owns the paper.
They don't know who owns it, and they can't easily access the note. It's very, very difficult. So if a homeowner loses their copy of the note, very, very difficult for the homeowner to ever get that from their lender.
It is also as part of the securitization process, which I think maybe you've heard about, but what the industry did was they took one mortgage and they pooled it with many, many other mortgages. And the theory was that, gee, you know, how could all these mortgages default at once? That can't happen. And in order to have that achieved, the securitization, they had to rapidly be able to move interests in the land from place to place to place to get it eventually, in theory, in what were called the securitization pools. And so that was part of the reason that MERS was born, was to allow that to happen rapidly. But there is also no question in the record that when MERS was being considered to be born, that they had a study done by, I think it was Ernst & Young, accounting firm, and they concluded that the major reason to start MERS was to cut out the costs of recording these instruments with the counties. And hundreds of millions of dollars have been lost in what I believe are taxes, user fees, if you will. And so it's been a disaster from a finance perspective, but the land recording system in our country started 300 years ago in the Plymouth colony, and the reason why was in Europe no one could tell who owned anything. So it was a really good system, and it's worked really well until this industry decided on its own to create a new one. And now I understand they're coming to the legislature to entice you to exempt them from these requirements retrospectively, which I think is, you know, probably void constitutionally as well. So maybe I've gone on a little bit, but hopefully that answers your question.
Thank you. Did you have a quick question?
Okay. If I could just add real quickly,
we're going to run out of time, and we have Mr. Quirin standing at his cell phone ready to
answer
now.
That'll be done at 2:05 on this bill. So
if we can get Mr. Quirin on the phone, that'd be helpful.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Appreciate it.
Sounds like a common sense solution for this would be to make sure that people held on to their loans for 5 years.
Mr. Chair, if you want to remind Mr. Quirin that he has very limited time.
Yep.
Not that I'm telling you how to.
Hello, Mr. Quirin.
Sir.
You are live with the General Government Consumer and Small Business Protection Committee, and we have you on speakerphone. We're already running a little bit behind on this bill, but we are very interested in your testimony, so just if you could keep it to 3 minutes or less, we'd be grateful.
All right, I'll do what I can.
All right. Fire away.
Thank you. Members of the Senate Committee on General Government Consumer and Small Business Protection, I have submitted in writing a summary of my support of this bill. By way of history, I've spent approximately the last 12 months meeting with homeowners, discussing with realtors, probably in the range of 100, 150, 200 folks, all of whom are suffering some form of distressed real estate transaction. And one of the issues that has come up and has been very apparent in the foreclosures that I've been involved in is that ORS 86735 has been roundly ignored. This is not something that is new. This is something that's been going on for some time. Of course, the precipitating factor right now is Judge Allen's decision in the McCoy case. And what I think is important in this bill is that it does nothing more than require the lenders to actually present to the party that they're foreclosing the very documents upon which the lenders have always said they rely. That would be the promissory note and the trust deed. And what we're looking at in this legislation is just simply a requirement that it be part of the notice of sale. So that's the sort of thing that Judge Alley referred to. And it's the sort of thing that essentially, without it, makes the foreclosures essentially void right now. So it is time to actually require both the lenders and the title folks to do what's necessary, and that is to have a law that is honored and enforced and protects the consumer, which is ultimately the goal here. And right now it's not been the case, hopefully anyway. The idea would be that this bill, if passed, would then allow the consumer to actually have an opportunity to see who it is that's foreclosing and whether or not they have a right to do so. With that, if any of you have any questions, I'd be happy to address them.
All right. That was very concise and much appreciated. Any questions for this witness, colleagues?
Just a minute.
One moment. Senator Bonamici is contemplating.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we'll rely on Mr. Quirin's written testimony. But he was a bit modest. If I could just add for the record, Mr.
Yes.
Chair, that Mr. Quirin's been a real estate lawyer, was the chair of the real estate practice group for a large law firm, taught real estate licensing law and real estate practices. So I just want to give a plug for his expertise on this issue. So thank you, Mr. Quirin. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Quirin, who do you practice law with now?
I practice law by myself, which allows me the pleasure of doing what I'm doing right now.
Much appreciated. But I guess the point I was getting at is that his history is not as a plaintiff's lawyer, but as a business lawyer. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Yes.
I would like to add, I don't know if this matter has been presented, but it's my understanding that there has or will be an effort on the part of the lenders to submit a bill in one form or another that would essentially allow MERS to continue in the capacity that it has. And I want to just emphasize that for
several years now that the law has been ignored, and I believe that the MERS bill, as it stands right now, will do nothing more than legitimize an illegal practice. And I think it's time to have the present bill 484 passed so that this practice of ignoring the law is stopped.
Great. Thank you very much for your testimony. Hope the weather in Dallas is nice.
It's up there, yes.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. All right, colleagues, I'd like to, I think now would be a good time to bring on some of the opponents so we can hear their point of view. Could we please bring up Paul Cosgrove and Hal Scoggins and Alan Brickley, if you like, also.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Paul Cosgrove, representing the Oregon Bankers Association, Oregon Financial Services, and I'll let these two gentlemen introduce themselves here in opposition to Senate Bill 484, as is the rest of the United Financial Lobby. There is a problem here, but we don't think this is the bill that the solution to the problem. And in fact, I think all this does is increase the level of paperwork and confusion that consumers now face in the foreclosure process. In 2008, we had a foreclosure process, which may not have been perfect, but it involved service of two sheets of paper generally. If you had very small print, you could do it on one sheet, but no one did it. It was unreadable. So two pieces of paper went to each borrower in the foreclosure process, and it pretty clearly delineated their rights and responsibilities. We have, in the years past, 2008, 2009, 2010, increased that so that the current pile of paper is 10 to 15 pages, and it's caused a number of things to be confusing to consumers because they're inconsistent and in some cases some of us would believe not completely accurate notices that have been created by the legislature as part of this process. This would in fact increase that pile of paper probably to the 25 to 30 page level, and we don't think that actually helps solve the problem and helps make the process easier. The real problem, however, is that there are nationwide data shows that MERS mortgages are about 60% of the residential mortgages in the country. We presume, and Mr. Brickley is here from one of the larger title companies, and he can testify about this directly, that we presume that that level may be actually a little bit higher in Oregon for a variety of market reasons. There are other mortgages, however, that are being handled in a similar way, not involving MERS, and those are those that are often assigned to Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and Ginnie Mae, semi-government organizations formed by the federal government, which entered into the same kind of process. So the real problem from our perspective is 75, 80, some number of all residential mortgages in the state of Oregon now have effectively a cloud on their title. And this has nothing to do about whether there's been a foreclosure involved. This has to do with houses that are where the loan has been reconveyed and sold to a new third party, or after a foreclosure, it's sold to a party and then resold to another party. All of those now, because of a decision, most recently the decision in the Eugene Bankruptcy Court, have called into question this issue. There are a number of people who believe that, in fact, current law could easily be interpreted a different way, and in fact has been interpreted similar laws in other states by other judges in different ways. But because of the decisions in this state, it's an issue that we hope this committee will agree needs to be fixed. And again, the reason is the magnitude of the problem is a very large number, perhaps as high as 80% of all residential mortgages and residential properties in this state now have a cloud on their title. I'd be happy to answer any questions. I just will close by saying we have been working as a group, involving others as well, on some amendments that we believe would solve the problem, would validate the titles of properties that have ever had a MERS loan on them, and going forward would be an appropriate solution to this problem from our perspective, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Gentlemen.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Hal Scoggins. I'm an attorney representing the Northwest Credit Union Association, which has its members credit unions throughout the state of Oregon and Washington. And Mr. Cosgrove eloquently articulated some of the issues that there are with this bill. Credit unions are all about transparency and service to their members, and credit unions are fully in favor of solutions to the problems that clearly have existed in the mortgage foreclosure arena. Unfortunately, we don't believe that this bill necessarily addresses many of those problems, which are servicing problems, foreclosure problems that don't necessarily relate to the chain of title. And those problems deserve solutions, but those solutions aren't in this bill. And in terms of the issues related to this bill, it's critically important that the person, the party that gets notices related to a mortgage, construction lien notices, notices of foreclosures by other lenders, things like that, that should be the party that's servicing the loan. We certainly wouldn't want to have a situation in which the party that owns the debt, which may be different than the party that's doing the servicing, often is the party that gets the notices and then is unable to take legally required actions based on those notices because they're not the ones that are actually servicing the loan. We want to be sure that the process is clear, transparent, and appropriate, and credit unions believe that an appropriate bill to remedy these problems would address those issues without further potentially creating clouds on titles of properties that are already out there, transactions that have already occurred, making the current real estate environment, which is, of course, adverse for all Oregonians, even worse. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Alan Brickley. I am an attorney. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Land Title Association. First of all, I would suggest that we're not opposed to the concept of transparency. I think everybody would agree that that is a necessary ingredient in this process. What our concern is, is that the preliminary, and I stress this, preliminary decisions by the bankruptcy and or district court in the state of Oregon create the possibility that there will be significant problems with title to various parcels of real property in Oregon, which leaves the possibility that the only way that can be resolved is through judicial foreclosure proceedings, which could be a very expensive, time-consuming process. The other alternatives is a title company would have to raise these issues, and the consumer then would either have the choice of either not purchasing or purchasing with the cloud on the title, which certainly is not a rational decision on the part of a consumer. So clearly it's going to create, if these decisions proceed, would create a very serious problem in terms of ownership of real estate in Oregon. As indicated earlier, what we're concerned about is all of these issues, and we are working on some proposals that at least I feel would address all of the appropriate and necessary issues in this regard.
Thank you. Just one comment, maybe, Paul, you can help me with this. In my district, North and Northeast Portland, we're now looking at maybe one out of four houses either in foreclosure or default or some way showing up on that database that one can look up to see how many houses are in danger. I can't for the life of me figure out why I wouldn't want those people to have access to judicial foreclosure if we did nothing. Can you help me understand why that would be a bad idea?
Mr. Chairman, be happy to at least try to. There are several reasons that judicial foreclosure is not a desirable remedy, and it hasn't been the remedy of choice in this state, either for our Department of Veterans Affairs or any other state agency housing division or housing department. The trustee foreclosure process is more certain and less expensive. Generally speaking, the timelines are much quicker. But I think, and for you, having facing the kind of budget deficit that you just talked about in context of another bill a little bit earlier in this hearing, the cost of judicial foreclosure would far outweigh the fees that the court system would receive for having those cases. So there'll be a major fiscal impact if we move everything in judicial.
Have you seen the Chief Justice's fees lately?
Very much so. And they are much, much higher, but they're still a fraction of the cost of the system. But lastly, and I think most importantly, the other three quarters of the residents in your district have a desire to have their properties be saleable. And we're in a down housing market. We hope that down housing market is less down relatively soon. And there's a lot of study that's being done all across the country about whether, in fact, further delays in the foreclosure process, getting through the number of loans that we have to do, and most of those are in default now, not because they were bad loans, but because the economy is awful and people don't have jobs. If we delay that process, we will continue to suffer lower than normal housing prices, which affect all the other people who aren't in default and, in fact, would like to at some point maybe sell or buy houses.
Senator George. Jim, I tend to agree with you that I think there's some frustration with this process that really should be vented at foreclosure generally and not necessarily this particular process. Let me tell you where I'm having a little bit of a hard time with this particular process. When you have a recording at the county courthouse, I can, as an interested part, or just as a member of the public, go and find out who owns a piece of property and who the lender is. With this particular process, in essence, the lender is completely shielded from, in essence, public records laws. So the only thing that's kind of getting me on this, where I think there could be a problem, is that the fact is that myself as a member of the public can't easily go to my county courthouse and find out not only who the person is who owns the house or has borrowed the money to own the house, but also who the ultimate lender is who owns that at that time. So I'm worried about the reason why we have public records laws is so that you can access that for a variety of business reasons, by the way. So with that being said, how do we make the process in this private company more easily accessible to our public records laws?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, and I'm not an expert on MERS, although I've learned a lot recently. my understanding is the MERS website, in fact, gives you that information. My understanding is that all the lender members of MERS... lender members of MERS are in favor of expanding access to that information to anyone who would go online, and that there are two exceptions to that, and those exceptions are Fannie Mae and Ginnie Mae. All the other private entity lenders are perfectly happy to have that documentation be available to anybody at any time, whether they have a MERS loan or not.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, if I might add to that.
You could, and then we're going to have to get on to the next panel. I appreciate that.
Thank you. The one thing that I would add to that is that under federal law, under the Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act, when a loan is sold, when the servicing of a loan is sold, then the parties to that transaction have to give notice to the borrower of who the new servicer of the loan is. And that servicer is the party that the borrower is supposed to deal with. And for that matter, that other people who might be interested in the chain of title are supposed to deal with in terms of construction, lien foreclosure people, anybody else who needs to serve a notice on the owner of that loan can serve it on the party that's of record in the real estate titles. So there is a method for the borrower to get in touch with the person that's servicing their loan and communicate with them. Now, if those federal laws aren't being followed, that's another matter. But again, that there is a law, there is a redress there already.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I just would add that part of our process as a title insurance or escrow company is to process and pay off existing loans so that when the new purchaser takes title that they will be free and clear of those loans. And it's been my experience that I am not aware, obviously anecdotally, but I am not aware of any situation in which a claim has been made by a lender that they didn't receive the proper payment. So we've been paying the right people all this time.
Thank you very much, gentlemen, for your testimony. We appreciate your points.
Thank you.
Could we bring up Don McCoy, Nancy Kortner, and Jessica Stevens? Welcome, and anything you can do to keep your testimony concise would be appreciated so we can get to the next bills, too. Welcome to the committee.
Okay, thank you. My name is Don McCoy, and I'm the McCoy versus PNC Bank. So nearly 4 years ago, I had to make a decision to stop making payments on my property in order to get the bank's attention for a loan modification. So I made that decision in about May of 2007. And by the fall of that year, I was able to get their attention enough to start a loan modification process, at which time I was treated extremely less than human throughout the process, had to chase them continually to get answers while foreclosure was imminent on my property. And so finally, at the 11th hour of that of that year, just prior to foreclosure, I was able to be denied of my loan modification. So I've been in real estate over 11 years, and I saw firsthand what many of my clients had been going through and experiencing it myself. It was not pretty at all. And so I was told I had less than 30 days and I had to move out. So I conjured up a very interesting thing called a short sale and started the process of a short sale and was ignored forthrightly by the bank through that short sale process. They would barely respond to me, and those buyers went away. Secondly, I had a second short sale for the property, and another set of buyers came. Same experience, same process. Was barely responded to by the bank, and then ultimately lied to that they never received the paperwork, and they didn't get it, even though I'd had plenty of experience in getting paperwork to banks. So finally, I recognized that the bank had no incentive to short sale because they wanted to collect mortgage insurance on my property and foreclose on it and sell it, even though they had already, I learned later, bundled the loan and sold it off earlier. So I went into a qualified written request format on my own and started asking some very specific pointed questions about the right to foreclose and whether they had the proper authority to foreclose. And so that, of course, gave me time while they, in the beginning, followed the qualified written request procedures through RESPA. And so then that didn't work anymore. After about 6 months, they just ignored me and started marching forth for foreclosure, ignored my qualified written request, so forcing me into bankruptcy to protect my property while I discovered my interests and where I stood. So that in 2008, there was a Chapter 13 that I was entering into, and just prior to the Chapter 13 and my attorney at the time, we challenged the bank to prove their right to foreclose, and out of the blue, they created an interesting document called an allonge, which had never been with any of the original paperwork prior. And so out of the blue comes an allonge with my misspelled name and other concerns of no documentation, no notarization, nothing. And so my Chapter 13, of course, staved off the foreclosure for quite a period of time. And then I withdrew the 13 and started in on a Chapter 7 and continued to file a qualified written request challenging the bank their right to foreclose. And so all this while preparing for the eventual day where I would end up in some type of a court. So finally, through Good Grief America of 2009 and their efforts, we were able to find an attorney that would pay attention, James Stout, and then my bankruptcy attorney who understood the issue pretty clearly, Keith Boyd. And between the three of us, we decided to get the property into a Chapter 13 in order to get it into federal court so that a federal judge would pay attention to this serious issue. And there were a variety of issues, but this is the one that he chose to rule on, was the MERS and the improper recording in the county records.
Great. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Senator Shields and committee. My name is Nancy Kerber, and I am the co-founder and executive director of Good Grief America. And we started this nonprofit a couple of years ago in Southern Oregon. We're working statewide. We started because we're in the mess ourselves. And we've been in our home 19 years. We've been homeowners 35 years, always made all payments on time. And we're told that our bank would not help us unless we got delinquent. And after 3 months of arguing with them, we did. And at which point, we filed for help. They threw us in foreclosure. And it's been 27 months we've been going around and around with them. We started talking to other community members, and we started our nonprofit. And our surveys show that 85% of our members are small business owners who always paid their bills. They weren't deadbeats. And they've made numerous efforts. Their problems and challenges have been similar to the ones that we've gone through. And so I'm here more on behalf of my cases in court right now as well. After 2 years, we finally filed a case because we have
numerous issues that are of concern. MERS is one of them. One of them is we found the pool where our loan sits. And the party foreclosing on us, we have two different entities making claims on us. And we had two questions, and it's pretty simple from a homeowner's point of view. I want to know who, and I want to know how much. And we can't get either answer. And we have been denied information on our qualified written request. We are told that is proprietary information, and we don't have to give it to you. And this, hundreds of our homeowners, we have over 500 homeowners in our organization now. MERS has complicated it when we call and ask for information. In fact, we've gotten the milestone reports. The gentleman who spoke here earlier said that this information is available. It is not available. When we do get a milestone report, it's usually because we pay an attorney who gets it demanded in a deposit or in discovery. It's very expensive for to get us. What we have found was that those milestone reports do not match with the pooling and servicing agreements of the SEC files, where they filed who owns our loan, who are the parties. We actually track and we trace. That's one of the things our group does. And we, at any time, are willing to share our research with your committees or any of the senators and congressmen. But the we will track and trace every player who is involved, and they are not all on the milestone reports that MERS puts out. And when we go onto that record on MERS to even get it ourselves, what we will find is quite often it says the investor chooses not to have their name shown. We get next to nothing without demanding it in court. So I'm here today on behalf of hundreds and hundreds of homeowners asking that we demand some transparency and that we hold these Wall Street players to the law of what Oregon law is. And I thank you for hearing us.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chair Shields and members of the committee. My name is Jessica Stevens, and I'm here testifying in support of Senate Bill 484 on behalf of SEIU Local 503. I'm just going to highlight a few points from my testimony. Recording these transactions is the only way to establish priority in a line of creditors. That is to say, if someone does not register their interest in a property and a second party does, the second person, even though they came afterwards, would have priority. And while Oregon currently requires recording happen at some point before a home can be foreclosed upon, we are facing serious problems without clear chains of title. County's recording would have provided a form of insurance or protection that one's interest takes priority. For providing the service, county clerk's offices charge a modest fee. Their revenues earned from these fees not only cover the administrative needs of the recording office, but also help support other local services. The recording fees are quite modest in Oregon, as Senator Bonamici mentioned. They are $36 to $48 per transaction. Most residential mortgages now have gone through the process of securitization, and industry experts, as was mentioned earlier, estimate that 60% of residential mortgages are now registered through MERS. We would argue that this is a reason to take action, as the one gentleman referred to this bill as being a homeowner's transparency tool. The mortgage banking industry is, in effect, seeking to maintain the same legal protections awarded through the county recording system, but without paying the county for its protection. Consequently, Oregon counties have experienced significant financial losses. Based on the number of mortgage originations from 2005 through 2009 in Oregon, it is estimated that there would have been over 1 million recorded property interest transfers, if not for MERS. The estimated money lost to just seven counties for those 5 years totals over $41 million. For example, money lost to Multnomah County totals over $10 million, lost to Deschutes over $4 million, lost to Clackamas over $6 million, lost to Washington County almost $8 million, lost to Marion County over $4 million, lost to Jackson $3.5 million, and lost to Lane County over $4 million. We came to that calculation by taking the number of mortgages, multiplying that by a factor of 60% on the estimation of how many mortgages were transferred through MERS, and that there are an average of 3 transfers that are required in order for a mortgage to be securitized, and multiplying that by the average recording fee. In January, in a New York Times article, a MERS spokesperson actually acknowledged, however, that some borrowers don't have access to all of the information about who owns and services your mortgage. MERS gives investors the right to withhold their names from being displayed in the database. A March 5th New York Times article relayed the following, that federal bankruptcy courts and state courts have found that MERS and its members' banks often confused and misrepresented who owned mortgage notes. In thousands of cases, they apparently lost or mistakenly destroyed loan documents. Also in that article, Alan Wade, a law professor, later matched MERS ownership records against those in the public domain. He said fewer than 30% of mortgages had an accurate record in MERS. And in response to the ruling that was earlier referred to by Judge Alley, the First American Financial Corp, one of the nation's largest title insurers, began warning lenders and buyers in title documents that it wouldn't insure titles with a cloudy public record in Oregon. So with that and with the concerns that the opponents have raised, I would argue that what is most responsible for the legislature to do is to take some action to provide the disclosure and transparency that homeowners need. This is the responsible action to protect Oregon homeowners, to protect the Oregon economy, and to protect the Oregon housing market. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Stevens. Senator
Bonamici. I'm not going to ask any questions. I have a lot, but I know there's still two more bills, so I just want to thank everybody.
Great. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else who wanted to testify on Senate Bill 484? Before we close, I think one of the things that if I could send to the people in the audience who are going to continue to work on this is that I haven't been convinced that we have to do anything here. That if this did go into judicial foreclosure, that I'm not convinced that that would be a bad thing, that people would have their day in court. So for those who are going to continue to work on the bill, I think if we're going to move it from this committee, it would need to be part of a broader discussion about foreclosure. I wouldn't be inclined to give people a chance to not have a judicial foreclosure if there wasn't some other things put in place to protect them. So that being said, I will close public hearing on Senate Bill 484 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 826. And I think we'll have a joint public hearing with Senate Bill 827. So that's opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 826 and 827 because I know some people will be testifying to both. Senator Bonamici, if it's okay, we have in the audience Keith Ivanovich, who was interested in testifying on one of the bills. I'd like him to get back to running the AG's office, and if you could come forward and give your testimony, we'll cut you loose.
Good afternoon, Chair Shields. My name is Keith Dubanovich, and I am Chief of Staff to the Attorney General. I am here to speak specifically on Senate Bill 827, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have on 826. As the committee knows, one of my primary responsibilities is to oversee the consumer protection activities in the Department of Justice. In the last year, we've received over 400 complaints about loan modification problems. A vast majority of these complaints concern unsatisfactory service during the loan modification process. And what I'd like to do is highlight a couple of those problems and then explain to you our view on how Senate Bill 827 would address those issues. For example, a Silverton resident applied for a loan modification in May of 2010. One thing that we've heard time and again is the applicant for the loan modification process sends the information in, they wait and they wait, then they're told that, gee, the bank lost the information, so they send the information again. And in this case, by August of 2010, he was told that the request for modification was in underwriting and that a trustee sale would not occur until the modification request was processed. By September, the underwriter requested additional information from the homeowner, and then a few days later, September 9, the home was sold at a trustee sale. The homeowner didn't know about the sale until September 13, when he called for an update about his loan modification request. Similarly, a Salem resident obtained a trial modification and made payments for 9 months, fully expecting that they had qualified for a full modification because they had fulfilled all of the requirements for the trial modification. She submitted additional documents, again, on a repeated occasion, and after paying under the loan modification, the trial loan modification process for 9 months, she was finally told, no, you don't apply for a loan modification, even though she had been complying with the terms for 9 months. Now, since April of 2010, we've received about 14 complaints that allege that a servicer has refused to meet with the borrower. And as you'll recall, in Senate Bill 628, that was one of the critical components of that bill, is that the consumer get an opportunity to have a conversation with the lender so that they could honestly understand, did they have any chance of having a loan modification request. And notwithstanding that statutory requirement, we've received a number of complaints that says the servicer just simply refuses to meet with the borrower. For example, one Staten couple, they didn't get a loan modification request form with the notice of sale, which is one of the requirements of Senate Bill 628. Notwithstanding that, the couple made inquiries on a number of occasions to see if they could get a loan modification and to meet with their borrower. Over the course of a number of weeks, they made repeated requests for a meeting with their lender, and in April in 2010, they learned from the servicer that, no, we're not going to meet with you because you didn't timely ask to meet with your lender. So these are some of the problems that we've seen time and again, and one of the biggest problems that we found in Senate Bill 628 was that there wasn't a good enforcement mechanism, and that's similar with the federal HAMP program, and is that there's no enforcement mechanism. And what this bill does is it provides an enforcement mechanism that will allow the Department of Justice to pursue lenders or servicers for violations of Senate Bill 628. What this bill will do is it requires DCBS to create a format for a loan modification request so everybody has the same form and everybody knows what the information is that's going to be required to get a loan modification. It makes a failure to provide the loan modification request an unlawful trade practice, and likewise, it makes the failure to timely respond to a loan modification request an unlawful trade practice act. Similarly, it requires the trustee to file an affidavit in the form that DCBS will be preparing that describes the beneficiary's or the beneficiary's agent's response to the loan modification request. One of the things we found is that the affidavits that are filed of court record don't really describe what, if any, effort the lender did to evaluate whether somebody's actually qualified for a loan modification request. One thing we did in the last session is we required that the affidavit be filed 5 days before the foreclosure sale. And our experience has been that that's simply insufficient time for the homeowner to be able to get the affidavit, potentially hire a lawyer, and then contest the affidavit. Because oftentimes the affidavit is a form that the bank is just simply filing at the court record, and it, as I've described, in many circumstances is a false affidavit. But if the homeowner only has 5 days to find a lawyer and then figure out what the legal process would be to stop the foreclosure sale, oftentimes it's too late. So what this bill does is it requires the filing of the affidavit 45 days before the foreclosure sale, which gives the homeowner an opportunity to contest the affidavit. So in summary, we continue to have a foreclosure problem in this state. As the chair noted, there are substantial problems in different regions of the state. For example, as Vice Chair George knows, Yamhill County, according to the recent statistics, one in every 497 homes in that county is in process of foreclosure. And you go into some of the more problematic counties like Jefferson, Crook, and Deschutes, and the rate is even higher. The problem is not going away. We saw a very temporary, I think, a drop in foreclosures during the month of February simply because of the court cases that have come out that say that, indeed, you must file of court record all assignments of a property before you can do the foreclosure. And so I don't think over the course of the next year that we're going to see much change in our foreclosure rate. And as a consequence, I think Senate Bill 827 is certainly a step in the right direction. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions of the committee.
Okay. Thank you, Keith. All right, and we are running a little bit late, so what I want to make sure that we do get, because I think we're going to have to roll this over, because I want to make sure that this topic gets more attention. We'll run all the way up to 3 o'clock. What I thought I would do next is bring up Angela Martin and then two of the people who came from over 100 miles. That would be Tim Collette and Karen McCarthy. And for those of you who are in the building on a regular basis, and David Tapman, we definitely want to hear from you as well, but those of you who are in the building on a regular basis, we'll roll you over until the next time. So if you're a lobbyist that would like to weigh in on this topic, we'll let you do this also. Ms. Martin?
Thank you. Chair Shields, members of the committee, Angela Martin with Economic Fairness Oregon. Thank you very much for hosting this hearing today. I'll speak first in support of Senate Bill 826, which proposes business conduct rules for mortgage servicers. We may all know at this point mortgage servicers are the entities that process payments, attempt to collect late payments, maintain escrow accounts, and engage in loss mitigation, including foreclosure proceedings if the loan is in default. Essentially, they are the entity that stands between the borrower and the foreclosure. And unfortunately, we're here today because this relationship has not really served the interests of the borrower or our economy. This is due in part to the lack of rules and oversight combined with the financial disincentives for servicers to pursue loss mitigation over foreclosure. Servicer violations have been uncovered in court cases, congressional testimony, and academic research, as well as conversations and interviews with homeowners. Those violations include excessive fees, improper denial of loan modifications, a lack of response, lengthy waiting periods, and conflicts of interest that lead servicers to favor foreclosures over modifications. Again, servicers are the entity that is standing between the borrower and that alternative to foreclosure that so many homeowners are seeking. And despite claims that the industry has made that there have been serious improvements, that's not playing out in the numbers. And the number of loan modifications has remained almost unchanged, and a tiny fraction of the number of homeowners that are actually in default. The average monthly modification as compared to delinquencies from 2009 to the end of 2010 never reached above 5%. In my testimony, I provide a more thorough review of this 26-page bill and what it would accomplish. I'm going to quickly touch on a few of the highlights. It would ensure that servicers deal with borrowers fairly and responsibly by establishing a good duty of faith and fair dealing. It would improve servicer accountability by requiring procedures to respond to and resolve borrower inquiries and complaints. It would protect borrowers from being charged excessive and unreasonable fees. And perhaps most important, the provisions regarding loss mitigation will help ensure that all options are exhausted and foreclosure is indeed the last resort. Finally, Senate Bill 826 will increase oversight and transparency through annual reporting and internal record keeping. Again, we urge your support for this bill. We appreciate your time on this on this hearing today. I want to speak quickly to Senate Bill 827. I always appreciate being able to follow Mr. Dubanovich because he did such a good job touching on the particulars of this bill. I will add to it that my testimony included a handy chart, which helps see that really what this particular bill seeks to accomplish is move the conversation between the homeowner and the borrower forward in the foreclosure process and establish a date certain time by which the homeowner understands if they have been denied for a foreclosure modification or if a foreclosure will be forthcoming, giving them the opportunity to make an actual decision. I'd like to end by sharing the voices of many of the homeowners that couldn't be here today. We've been in conversation with lots of homeowners across the state and put together a quick clip video for the committee, so if that's okay.
And these will be the last two people to testify because we're running up on the 3 o'clock. But again, I would invite...
it wouldn't be so bad if I just made poor decisions. That's on me. But I had retirement, I had emergency fund, I had savings, I had everything. Everything was paid for except for my house. Everything. And now it's all gone.
I've never gotten unemployment. So to be at this point, it's very new and scary.
It's unbelievably tough in this market. I can't explain how hard it is.
I just feel like my back's against the wall.
Money to buy groceries. Get tired of eating potatoes.
I've never seen anything like this. This is just terrible.
In a heartbeat, things can change.
First modification I did, I would call all the time. Do you need anything else? I can't tell you what's going on. And I thought, well, and then about 6 months to a year later, they said, well, it's your responsibility to call and find out what's going on. I said, I did that, but you wouldn't tell me anything.
We began our modification process December 2nd, 2009. It is ongoing. Our foreclosure date has now been set at April 11th.
We're on number five, going towards number six.
I'd send them FedEx packages. They wouldn't give them. They'd send me the same application over and over again. I kept filling them out, sending them back.
Not once have I talked to the same person.
It seemed like every time I faxed it, they were missing some.
They dropped me from the program because they said I didn't comply and I didn't send in the necessary paperwork. It turns out that the requested paperwork they wanted was something they never requested from me.
Everyone I spoke to had their paperwork lost at least once. And these are mortgage companies that are in the paperwork business, that all they do is paper, mortgages, refinances, loans. These are banks.
And I'm looking at copies, and they're saying it's not there. And then in the end, finally beg, plead, and bleed that somebody checks the system once again, and gee, finds out that it's there, but now it's too late.
They must have just a giant stack of my paperwork.
Banks made money when they made the bad loans. They make money when they're foreclosing on loans. There's something wrong with that. I've been in business 38 years. If I make a mistake, I pay for it. They're not. They're getting paid for it. Something's wrong somewhere. It's broken and it needs to be dealt with.
This is just not right. Something's got to be done.
I'd like to see some laws made here so people don't get trapped.
This is not just a situation that's going to go away overnight. It's not going to go away at all until you guys step in and start helping us out.
I think they need to act from their conscience. I think they need to have a feeling that their constituents are men and women just like their own family members are. These are your mothers and your grandmothers and your uncles and your cousins and your grandchildren that you're making an impact on. This is a web. This is a family. We're all family.
Chair Shields and the committee, thanks for your time. My name is Tim Collette. I'm from Bend, Oregon, at least for another 3 weeks. My home is being foreclosed, even though I never stopped making payments. I made them until they refused to take them. When I bought the house, I made the payments very easily. I sold other properties to get into that house more than one. The That was part of my retirement package. And I've been through the process three different times. And when they're refused, they never tell you why. It's just that you're not getting it and we're moving forward. When you are trying to do everything you're told to do and reply with all the requests that they make and you get nothing in return, and it's like everybody said, every time you send something in, it goes straight to the paper shredder. And they don't tell you that. You wait for an answer and, you know, 2 months, 3 months later, you finally call up and they say, well, we didn't get it. And I go, why didn't you say so? I got confirmation on the faxes when I send the stuff in. Now you're telling me you didn't get any of it. And that's happened numerous times. I can't tell you how much paperwork I've faxed into them, and they never got it. So it's been the most frustrating thing in my life. During all this time, I emptied out my retirement, my savings, everything to make my house payments. All for nothing. In 3 weeks, they're taking it. I've worked hard since I was 12 years old. I believe I've earned my piece of the American dream, and they're taking it. If I'd have made the mistakes, made poor judgments, that's fine, but everything I own is paid for except for my house. It was all tied up in that. And now it's gone. I don't trust the feds to come up with laws that protect me. I think they're working too closely with the banks at the upper level, and I don't. Their answer to everything is give them more money. I think we need local legislation because it's more efficient, it's more effective. And I'm not saying you need to tell the banks how to do business, but I think we have the right to say if you're going to do business that way, you're not going to do it here. I urge you to support these bills. I think they're the right thing to do, and we need some help. We are not getting anywhere dealing with them ourselves. We need to have some laws with some teeth in them to protect the consumer. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Good afternoon, Senator Shields and Vice Chair George. My name is Karen McCarthy. I'm from Madras, Oregon. It's in Jefferson County. It's one of the counties that you mentioned as being very hard hit, along with Deschutes and Crook counties in Central Oregon. My partner is a farmer. He's a hay farmer, grows grass hay in Madras, Oregon. And we've been hit very hard by this. He's been attempting for almost 2 years now to get a modification. He keeps going from the modification to modification at the bank's urging, and he's been paying all the way up till this January when he finally stopped consciously making any payments because he was at the point where he realized that after our notice of default in November, subsequent trying to get the right thing, you know, get information from the bank, he decided that that was it. He is not going to pay, and he is going to, you know, try to fight back. And hopefully we can get some legislation going. Right now he's in a total state of limbo. As I mentioned, it's not just our house, it's our farm, it's his livelihood. He's never was late on a payment, but when the economy tanked and 2008, it became very difficult for him to make a payment. He still was making payments, but at the bank's urging and suggestion, he skipped a few payments so he could qualify to get in the HAMP program. Anyway, here I am a couple years later, and we're fighting tooth and nail to keep our property and keep our livelihood. And he's gone ahead and made the decision to purchase irrigation water and fertilizer and to go ahead with his repairs on his equipment to keep the farm moving forward. However, we're in a state of limbo along with, you know, hundreds of thousands of other people in the country. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I think, colleagues, we have to vacate the room because of the next hearing that's up. I apologize that I wasn't able to manage the time like I would have preferred. So we're going to roll over additional testimony because I think this is an incredibly important topic. I think going to the name of this committee, Small Business Protection, it's also shown me that the equity that people have in their houses are often the collateral that people use to run their businesses as well. And you can be assured that we're going to take some significant action on this from this committee. That being said, if we'll reserve the first 20 to 25 minutes of the next meeting for people who still would like to testify. We do want to hear from the opponents, particularly because I haven't given them a whole lot of time on this type on these two bills. So let's close the public hearing on Senate Bill 826 and 827, and this meeting is adjourned.